Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to another weekend. Coming up, Chuck Wendig is going to tell us about why he writes horror novels that still have a dash of hope.
I think having a little bit of hope and a little bit of heart and a little bit of humor, which is all H words.
But first, let's sit back and unwind from the week that was with two excellent humans. With us this week, we have Patrick Hines. He co-hosts the True Crime Obsessed podcast and is the author of the new book, Failure Is Not an Option. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. Also here is Kristen Meinzer. She co-hosts the Daily Fail podcast, which does comedic close readings of tabloids. And she also co-hosts How to Be Fine, which looks at the good and bad of the wellness industry. Kristen, hello.
Greta, thanks so much for having me back on the show. I'm so excited to be here with you and Patrick.
Yay. Okay, so today is Friday the 13th. Are you superstitious people?
Whenever I forget about Friday the 13th, and then it will be a random Friday the 13th, and I'll get really excited. I'm like, is today the day I meet a werewolf? I'm always on the lookout. I'm a Bigfoot person. I feel like werewolf is Bigfoot adjacent.
Oh, yeah.
I want to meet the whole clan. You know
what
I mean?
Oh, my gosh. Amazing. What do you think, Kristen?
I like to think of myself as a super logical person. I like to think I am not superstitious. I know a lot about the history of where superstitions come from. You know, for example, salt. When we spill some, we put it over our shoulder, you know, toss them over the shoulder, because salt used to be very prized and expensive. But now I can get like a whole container of Morton's for $1. So, right. You know, like, who cares? But I do have a confession. How to Be Fine, back when we used to be called By the Book, we lived by a self-help book that was about tarot cards. And while we were living by the rules of that book, I was filled with dread every day, because one thing we had to do each day was pick a tarot card of the day that would somehow determine our purpose for the day or our day's mood or whatnot. And every single day I came to dread the moment when I had to pick my card of the day. So apparently I am superstitious, because I was so scared of those cards. I was terrified of them.
That's so funny. The cards are beautiful, Kristen. You just got to go with it.
I don't know. The deck I had, everything looked like murder.
I do not consider myself to be a superstitious person at all, but Friday the 13th in March of 2020 was the first day we worked from home because COVID was like just starting. At least for me, it happened to be a Friday the 13th.
Can I just like, on a note of hope, though, say that this episode right now is airing on Friday the 13th with all of us together. Isn't that a sign that this is actually a good
day?
So it's got to be a good day. Oh, Kristen, you are so sweet. I love it. You're just the best.
It's the same idea of like gays burning in hell. I'm like, well, great. Like, that's where the party is. Like, why would you want to go anywhere else? Send me straight there.
That's what my great grandma always said. I would never know anyone in heaven anyway.
Exactly.
Okay, so another story I want to talk to y'all about from this week is about Jens Hanning. He's a Danish artist. He was commissioned to make a piece of art for a museum in Aalborg, and they paid him the kroner equivalent of about $70,000. And they commissioned him to make a piece for their exhibit that was all about labor. And the piece he turned in ended up being a blank canvas, and it was titled Take the Money and Run, which I think is hilarious and amazing. The museum took him to court, and he ended up having to pay the money back, which is such a huge bummer. But I would love to talk to y'all about this story, because I think it does introduce a lot of really interesting questions around capitalism and art and worth. And Patrick, do you think he should have had to pay that money back?
Well, but here's the thing. One of the details of that story is that the museum, like the piece was supposed to be currency, either like taped or in some way, yes, like fastened to the canvas as the art. And so the mm-hmm. museum gave him the money to do that with the understanding that he was going to give that money back when the exhibit was over, because it was like part of the exhibit. He literally turned in a blank canvas and kept the money, called it Take the Money and Run, and they exhibited the art piece as he exhibited it. So I'm sorry, I'm on this guy's side. I think him keeping the money was part of the art. Like, I love these art stories because art is at once so incredible and so ridiculous that, like, if he pocketed the money that was supposed to be part of the exhibit and they exhibit the thing anyway without the cash, and he literally calls it, I stole your money, the money is his. The money is his.
I do think the like bummer small print of it is that, like, they did commission him to make specific pieces of art.
Uh-huh.
Which he did not. Mm-hmm. But I love what you're saying, and I think he totally should have been able to keep it. Kristen, what do you think?
Well, like you, I really admire his gumption and his sense of humor. It really does raise questions. You know, his art raises questions about labor and what does it mean to actually be a laborer and who holds the power and, you know, what is elitism and so on. And I would argue, in a way, it's not just the museum that is made up of a bunch of elitists. It's also him, the artist. And so I don't necessarily want to take a side, because I'm like, you are a well-to-do artist who can do things like this and laugh it off if you want to. You know who can't do that? The other 99% of the world, like everybody on this call right now, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
And also, he did not fulfill that contract, as both of you have pointed out. He had a contract to do a certain thing. For example, if I am going to commission somebody to paint a portrait of my beloved late dog, and they come back and just give me a blank canvas or a picture of a lizard
and
instead,
they're like, fuck you, Kristen.
Yeah, it's like, like, if you don't like this lizard, then you hate animals. It's like, no, I commissioned you to do a portrait of my late dog. So come on. Give me what I paid for.
I don't know, because they displayed the piece, and so, like, the museum made money off of the art. But I like the idea that, and I'm just making this up, but that, like, the museum and the artists were in cahoots, and it was like, we'll give you the cash, and then you steal the cash, and then we'll hang up the art, and then we'll sue you, and the whole thing is a commentary on labor. I love that idea.
Okay, I want to believe that's true. Please say that's true. Yes, and then that means they would have succeeded in drawing even more attention to what this was supposed to be about in the first place.
I mean, we're talking about it, you know, here we are.
Yeah.
Okay, so another story from the week that is doing a lot in the best possible way is about a lady who tried to bring giraffe poop back from her trip to Kenya. She declared it at customs at the airport in Minneapolis, and they confiscated it. Apparently, she wanted to make a necklace out of it, which is a thing that she had done with moose poop, which I am actually oddly familiar with because I grew up in Alaska. But anyway.
Hold on, did you have moose poop jewelry, Greta?
You know, it's funny because I totally forgot about it until reading this story. I was in like a church youth group in junior high, and there was like a nationals meetup in Seattle or St. Louis. I can't remember which one, but we actually spray painted like 1,000 little moose poop pellets gold and gave them out to people.
Wow.
So we brought those on the plane.
Wow. But wait, she was coming back from a foreign country. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like a whole other level.
Because like they were saying that like the moose poop could actually be carrying diseases. Like I'm your fun gay best friend. I want everyone. I want poop everywhere all the time. But like, I definitely do defer to the scientists on this. Like I'm glad she declared it. She didn't she could have probably gotten away with it if she hadn't.
Right. She kept it on.
But like, they're saying that, like, I don't know, there's enough going on in the world that we don't need, like, we don't need diseases that we don't already have. Like, I guess what I'm saying is I can't go back into lockdown, so please keep your poop in your country. That's all. That's all.
I feel the same way. I totally agree with you. I'm just like, this could be the next pandemic. Most pandemics come from poop, directly or indirectly. It's always about the poop, right? So it's like, please don't bring your poop here.
Only because poop is filthy. Yeah. Other than that, I celebrate poop all day, every day.
Yeah. I do think, in defense of the poop, I mean, at least with my familiarity of moose poop, it's sort of like rabbit pellet poop, where it's like very, you know, they're vegetarians. It's not, you know, it's not like nasty poop. But I
think
totally
what we're
hear you, and I think
losing in the story here is how awesome giraffes are. Can we talk about how just like amazing giraffes are for
yes,
a second?
I think we should zoom out, Patrick. I think we
Thank
should.
Thank you. So they give birth standing up. Those babies come flying out. They can basically walk from birth. Oh. Like, I'm obsessed.
They're
purple
so
tongues.
Cool. Those necks, they're amazing.
I know.
They're magnificent.
Cool,
they really are. But one thing I just want to say, just to be kind of a negative Nancy here, poop art, not that sophisticated, not that good,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
It reminds me of, you know, I'm a senior in high school or a freshman in college trying to make provocative art, and it's not provocative, it's just poop, you know?
It's just poop.
It's just poop. So, like, if you want to be provocative, just do better.
Do better. Oh, my God. I love it. Okay, that's fair. Okay, so lastly, the rubbery shoe company Crocs is making, like, a limited run of cowboy boots. And I don't even know what to say about this. It's so they have spurs. I guess I'll say that. They're $120. They have spurs. Patrick, would you wear these?
No, they're so ugly.
They're
and like
terrible.
I am hashtag gay with no taste. I barely know what I'm talking about. But like, I looked at the picture of them and they were so ugly. I also, and I mean no offense to anybody, but like, I don't understand the Crocs. I don't understand the Crocs. I don't, they're shoes with like rubber shoes with holes in them and people love, I just really don't smear giraffe poop on my feet any day. I can't do the Crocs.
It's funny because I'm not into the Crocs either, but Birkenstock makes a very, I mean, it's the same like kind of rubbery waterproof texture in their sandals. And I do own like 7 of those. So like I can't, you know, I'm not above it. Let's just be clear about that.
Yeah.
Kristen, would you ever wear something like this?
Well, I have to confess something and I don't say this out loud very often.
Are you
it's
a
just
Crocs
between,
guy?
Well, I... for several years wore those Croc canvas slip-ons. They looked kind of like Vans, but they had the footbed of Crocs.
Oh,
and
wow.
I kid you not, they were some of the most comfortable shoes
I
owned, and I owned them for years. My husband met me and I was wearing them and he still married me, okay?
Oh, so that's beautiful.
So they weren't that hideous. Apparently, he still liked me. But I I'll say this. I think that the new cowboy boot Crocs, as ridiculous as they are kind of fun. I think they're kind of like wearing cartoons on your feet. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I look at these cowboy boots and I'm like, I think I would wear them. I think I'd do it.
Oh my gosh. Well, Kristen, Patrick, thank you both so much for coming on. This was very, very fun.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, this was such a blast. Thanks, everybody.
Right after the break, we are going to hear from Chuck Wendig about his very seasonal and extremely creepy new novel.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max. And listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Our next guest is Chuck Wendig. He is the author of a number of books, including Wanderers and The Book of Accidents. And his latest horror novel, Black River Orchard, is extremely timely. He took inspiration from an apple stand at his local farmer's market.
They had all of these apple varieties that I had never heard of, and I was fairly certain that it was a prank. Like Lord Lambourne, it sounds like a vampire, right? Like Ashmead's Colonel. Aesopus Spitzenberg, Winter Banana.
So he obviously took them home and he tasted every one of them.
Already at that moment, I was way too interested in what, like, how does this happen? How does this happen that I've never had this? No one's had this. This feels like a made up thing.
This fascination led him to write this new book. It's about a farmer and his daughter struggling to keep their Pennsylvania apple farm alive. Dan, the father, manages to come up with the most delicious apple in the world. At first glance, it seems like eating it might actually make you the best possible version of yourself. But as it turns out, the dark red apples carry a dark history and some downright disturbing side effects. My friend Anna Bauman, who produces Nerdette, is a huge fan of Chuck and his work. So she was super excited to sit down with him and talk all about this spooky new book.
Okay, so apples are ripe for mythmaking. No pun intended. I'm sorry for doing that. But they are, you know, because there's the Garden of Eden, there's Johnny Appleseed, the saying is American as apple pie. So why apples?
Well, first of all, like you said, it is, quote unquote, ripe for all of this stuff. I mean, the Garden of Eden, yeah, but also Eris, myth of Eris, the apple of discord. Causing a great deal of chaos in Olympus. But also just, I really like apples. They really are a fantastically fascinating fruit in the fact that there are, 7,000-8,000 different varieties of apple, and we only generally are exposed to maybe 20 of them maximum at our grocery store. It's my turn for the puns. That kind of planted seeds had a gruesome, strange fruit, so to speak.
One aspect of this book that I really loved was the setting. It's set in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and that's a really core part of the book. And I actually grew up going to a sleepaway camp. It was a Quaker camp in Bucks County.
Well, what camp? Do you mind if I ask?
Camp Onus.
Camp Onus. I did Camp Onus.
You went to Camp Onus?
Yeah, it's cool.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I could totally imagine vividly your descriptions of the place and put myself there, like it's on the Delaware River. But I don't have to see that every day, and you do.
Like, I do.
How does it feel to imagine these terrifying things happening in your home?
Really easy, because I grew up here. So, I think when you grow up in a place like it, you both love it, but also recognize all of its sort of downsides. And at a certain point during growing up, you inevitably hate wherever you live or are from. Like, oh, I hate this place. I'm getting out of here.
Right.
And I think, that just having that sort of baggage around an area. And plus also, I know all the creepy folklore and horror stories, in some cases real, but generally mythical and imagined around this area. So it's actually pretty easy for me. And it's got that old... There's a lot of old history here, so there's layers of just weird stuff that's been going on over 200-300 years. So I had no problem imagining the terror.
You know, another aspect of this book that I really enjoyed was the main character, Calla, who's a teen, she's a teenager dealing with teenage things. And it's a lot about her complex relationship with her dad. And that was true for Wanderers also.
Yeah.
And I really liked how you evoked the ugh, dad part of being a teenage girl, but you also treated them with tenderness and showed that there's her strength. And I wonder what you do to inhabit that voice and also be respectful of it.
In part, just because, I was a teenager and I'm currently raising a preteen. So I'm starting to kind of, I'm getting it. I start to see it coming. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of being sort of respectful to them, I think it is the question almost answers itself. I am trying to be respectful of the characters. I'm not trying to be sympathetic in the sense that I feel bad for them, but I'm trying to be empathetic and because everybody comes from somewhere and none of this stuff is, whatever behaviors you have, good and bad and in the middle, it's born out of something. Again, not to get punny, but there's roots to that. And so everybody's a hot mess. I think when you sort of accept that everybody's a hot mess, you understand it a little more. And when you embrace yourself as a little bit of a hot mess and be like, we're all weird works in progress, in a variety of ways. And so treating characters like that, I think, tends to allow you to find their weaknesses and strengths and, see how they play off each other.
I appreciate that. Especially because Calla wants to be an influencer is one of her dreams.
Yeah.
And that could so easily be made fun of. And there's a little bit of that from the people in her life. But it's also, you show she actually has reasons for it. And it gets to why she wants to be recognized by the people in her life too.
Yeah. And sometimes that's all it is just asking well, why is this? Not just it is that way. Ha ha. Or yay. It's there's why is this? What is the origins of that? What are the, again, roots of it? So I think trying to figure that out is always both a fun exercise and is the thing that lends them that level of complexity that hopefully allows us to understand them better and feel you're a part of the journey as opposed to just sort of watching a symbol inside of a story do something or be something.
So I actually first read Wanderers because a number of Nerdette listeners said it was the longest book they had ever read.
Fair. Yeah.
And this one is also long. It's over 600 pages. So yeah. What is it about long books for you?
You know, first of all, like I don't try to write long books. It was like Wanderers, I was, you know, when I was writing that book, I was maybe a week away from deadline and I was at about 180,000 words, and which is the longest thing I had ever written by like 60,000 words. And okay. I went to my editor and I was like, I am this far into the book and I don't see an ending. So that feels bad. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, well, just keep writing, like write the book that it needs to be. Let it be the length that it's going to be. And at first I was like, well, that's clearly a sign she's been taken hostage, because no editor is going to be like, don't worry about that deadline. Just make a huge book. We'll just publish the huge book. And but that's really what she meant. She was not in peril, as it turns out. And I took her advice and I added another 100,000 words to the book. Ugh. And that just kind of was what it was. And the story took that shape. But the other thing is, like, as a kid, really liked long books sometimes. Like, not always. Sometimes you like that short. Like, even now, like, sometimes you can hand me a really sharp novella. It's like an amuse-bouche of story. It's great. But sometimes you want that seven-course epic thing.
Mm-hmm. How often do you think about the apocalypse and why?
that's the kind of interview it's going to be. More often now than I'd like. But I remember thinking about it a lot even as a kid, because, you know, like Gen X, it was like, hey, you know, have a good day, everybody. Don't forget, like, Russia might send nuclear weapons your way overnight. So good night, sleep well. And you're like, what? Oh my, that sounds horrible. Listen, I'm sure every generation has some measure of like, hey, the world is kind of in some ways precariously on an edge. And we're dealing with a number of those edges, I think, currently. So
right.
I like to think it's normal, probably more often than I should. But at the same time, I'm like, how are you not thinking about the apocalypse at least a little bit every day? I'm like, the apocalypse, right?
Okay, so then how do you balance out that dire realism with, you know, hope for future generations, especially as a parent?
This is literally why I wrote The Book of Accidents, my book that came out prior to this, because that's very much a book about sort of generational trauma and what we pass down to our children and how we try to, like, some characters in the book are like building what they consider like an emotional seawall. Like, how do I stop all of this stuff that's inside me from crashing down on my kids? And of course, doing that doesn't really work either. Like, that's not necessarily a healthy way. But sort of one of the conclusions that one of the characters comes into in the book is one that is mine. It's not really theirs. It's something that came from me, which is, you know, for as much as I feel dire about the world around us, at the same time, like, it sounds really cliche to say, but it's going to be the children who will save us, and not in a superhero way, in a nuanced, uncomfortable, messy way, but they're the ones who are the hope.
I mean, I think even though this book was like, had some really dark, scary, it was very dark and scary in a lot of ways, but there was also a lot of hope in it, and in hope in like banding together in a group. And I felt the same way with Wanderers.
Thank you. Yeah. That's the goal. Like, there's nothing wrong with the kind of horror that goes to some really nihilistic places. And I read that horror happily. But from a writer's perspective, like, I always, sometimes it's like the death and nihilism and the completely unhappy ending, like the nothing good comes out of this ending. I don't always find that I can find a point in me writing that. If only because the light and the darkness is what makes you see the darkness. If it's just all dark, it's like a taste that numbs out. Like, I think having a little bit of hope and a little bit of heart and a little bit of humor, which is all H words, and I don't intentionally mean that, but against the other H word, horror, I think there are important counterbalances to all of that.
That's very Quaker of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chuck, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
All right, that's it for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening. A quick little book club update, as we are pretty much at the midway point of this month. We would love to know what you think of Lauren Groff's book, The Vaster Wilds. We've already gotten a couple of voicemails, which is very exciting. You can send yours in by recording yourself on your phone and then emailing the file to nerdatpodcast@gmail.com. It is also never too soon to start the November book club selection. It is Land of Milk and Honey by C. Pam Song. So get onto that one as well. Nerdette is produced by me and Anna Bauman at WBEZ in Chicago and is part of the NPR network. And Brendan Banaszak is our executive producer. We will see you next week.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.